From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's the largest mass poisoning of a population in history. 35 million Bangladeshis are drinking arsenic as the World Bank and the government of Bangladesh stall on a plan for safe water. We'll have a roundtable discussion and go to an arsenic conference in California. Two survivors of the Bhopal disaster are hospitalized after an 18-day fast protesting the Union Carbide gas leak 17 years ago. The toxic legacy still haunts Bhopal today. Death toll at 20,000 and counting. We'll go to a hunger striker in the streets of Delhi. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush presented his long-awaited national homeland security strategy Tuesday. The 71-page blueprint calls for sweeping new powers for the federal government, new extradition and secrecy laws, the use of thumbprint and eyeball scanning for foreign visitors, the development of screening tools to predict human behavior, the stockpiling of newly developed vaccines, and letting the Army impose quarantines during a biological attack. The plan relies heavily on science and technology. Until yesterday, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other senior Pentagon officials had repeatedly denied they planned to ask Congress to overturn a fundamental law dating back to 1878 that sharply restricts the military's ability to participate in domestic law enforcement. But now the administration argues for a, quote, thorough review of the law. Meanwhile, War Secretary Rumsfeld is cracking down on leaks from the Pentagon. He warned senior Pentagon officials that leakers will be prosecuted. This, as Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, gave his most explicit warning to date about the need for a preemptive military strike against Iraq. Appearing before a committee of members of the British Parliament, America's chief ally in Europe insisted no decision had yet been taken by the U.S. over whether to attack Iraq. During a 2.5-hour question and answer, Blair noted that the West had failed to make a preemptive strike against bin Laden's al-Qaeda, which the U.S. blames for the September 11th attacks, even though the movement had been known long before them. Blair was asked whether there was any evidence linking Hussein with al-Qaeda. He said, "There, as far as I'm aware, not evidence linking Hussein to the actual attack on September 11th. Pressed on whether Hussein could be linked with the al-Qaeda movement, he said, "There are various rough linkages there." Here at home in New York, a federal jury Tuesday convicted former police officer Charles Schwarz of perjury, but deadlocked on the more serious charges. Schwarz is accused of leading Haitian immigrant Abner Louima into a precinct bathroom and holding him down while officer Justin Volpe raped Louima with a broomstick. Schwarz was earlier found guilty of helping Volpe commit the assault and with obstruction of justice, but a federal appeals court overturned those charges. Now a jury has found Schwarz guilty of lying when he denied he'd led Louima into the bathroom, but the jurors said they couldn't reach a unanimous verdict on whether Schwarz also lied about being present in the bathroom or on charges of conspiring to deprive Louima of his civil rights. The jury was comprised of 9 whites, 2 blacks, and 1 person of Middle Eastern descent. Herb Boyd is with us, national editor at the Black World Today, author of 9 books, including Brother Man, The Odyssey of Black Men in America. Welcome to Democracy Now!
It's good to be with you. Amy.
Your response to the verdict, Herb?
Well, you know, you got one of these partly sunny, partly cloudy. Is the glass half empty? Is it half full? It reminded me of the All-Star game. Of course, the analogy wouldn't hold in terms of the brutality connected with the case, in terms of ending with a tie, 7-7, you know? But I think that both sides claim victory and both sides claim to be disappointed. So where are we with this thing? Possibly a fourth trial, although the prosecution has not exactly said they're ready to move in that direction, but Weingrad said he is prepared to go to a fourth trial with Schwarz.
Were you surprised that while they said Schwarz clearly lied, that they weren't willing to say that he was in the bathroom?
Well, I think what happens is that it was just, you know, watching this trial, it was pretty confusing in terms of where they stood. First of all, the charges. In fact, let's go back to the jury itself in terms of just go ahead and paneling the jurors. There was some concern about that when you have, like you say, one of Middle Eastern descent there in terms of one of the jurors. I don't know what that means, Amy, but anyway, we thought it was like 10 whites and 2 black. 2 black men were there. So they said somebody had some kind of bias, went into this trial with the predisposition, you know, with the bias there. I'm not sure who that member of the jury was, you know, that had this particular kind of feelings going into the trial. It could have been one of the white men or one of the white women there, too, because it was 2 white women involved. But anyway, I think that I was not at all surprised because I thought that they would probably look for some compromise in this whole situation, given the nature of the readbacks. They started asking for Eric Teresky's readback on him, Mark Schofield. And these are 2 officers, Amy, who actually saw Schwartz lead Luima to the bathroom. They couldn't say, I guess the jury was confused whether or not he stepped across that line. But even if he was anywhere in that vicinity, I think we have to begin to talk about some kind of complicity here.
Herb Boyd, thank you for joining us. Herb Boyd, national editor of Black World Today and professor of African and African-American history at the College of New Rochelle in Manhattan. Israeli forces conducted a massive manhunt in the Rocky Hills of the West Bank early today, searching for the Palestinian gunmen who ambushed a bus near a Jewish settlement, killing 8 settlers. Israeli troops shot and killed 1 Palestinian suspect. British researchers have found that genetically modified DNA material from crops is finding its way into human gut bacteria. The research was commissioned by the Food Standards Agency and is the world's first known trial of GM foods on human volunteers. Federal Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan testified to Congress Tuesday that a corporate culture blighted by infectious greed is the cause of the breakdown in confidence among investors. He reassured Congress that the economy is fundamentally sound and poised for improvement. The House rushed to pass a bill that would toughen the penalties for corporate fraud one day after the Senate unanimously passed a broad overhaul of corporate and securities laws. But top House Republicans said they'll try to delay and likely dilute some of the proposed changes. Meanwhile, lobbyists representing the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and accounting firms are already roaming the halls of Congress seeking help. Spanish forces today stormed a disputed island off Morocco's Mediterranean coast, ousting Moroccan troops camped there since last week. And this news from Paraguay: police dispersed hundreds of demonstrators Tuesday after the president declared a state of emergency in response to widespread protests that have left 2 people dead. And in Ecuador, protests against Occidental Petroleum, 8 people have been arrested, including U.S. environmental tree sitter Julia Butterfly.
Ooh, who knows what we're gonna do to whoever you are. You who care more about your dollars than your human sense, you better box it up and send some back to where it came from. He mixes poison and he spills it on the world, and he's got 2 of everything you've never dreamed of. And he hears say, I am rich, baby, and there's no way I'm gonna box it up and send some back to where it came from. I think it's the right time for a sublime detonation of a new beginning. It's the right time for a sublime detonation of a new beginning. Disparity everywhere, he says, it's not my problem. She's got dirty underwear, he'll never get his stuff together. He'll say, I'll be rich someday, and there's no way I'm gonna box it up and send it back to where I came from. I think it's the right time for a sublime detonation of a new beginning.
Sublime detonation, Julie Rickman here in our Firehouse studio. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Resistance Radio. Reading from the New York Times of this past Sunday, a major expose. The arsenic, a slow, sadistic killer, has just about finished its work on Fazila Khatun. She teeters now. The fatigue is constant. Pain pulses through her limbs. Warts and sores cover the palms of her hands and the soles of her feet, telltale of the long years of creeping poison. Mrs. Khatun is hardly alone in this suffering. Bangladesh is in the midst of what the World Health Organization calls the largest mass poisoning of a population in history. Tens of thousands of Bangladeshi show the outward signs of the same decline. Some 35 million are drinking arsenic-contaminated water, the poison accumulating within them day by day, sip by sip. For two decades, the government, along with UNICEF and various aid groups, desperately worked to wean the nation from pond water, often an incubator for lethal disease. People were instead urged to install tube wells, tapping into the plentiful supply of underground aquifers. But no one had tested these subterranean sources for arsenic. By the mid-90s, Bangladeshi officials finally admitted that yet another tragedy was unfolding in their impoverished, disaster-plagued nation. In 1998, the World Bank sped the normal paperwork and lent the government $32.4 million to act on the emergency. Every tube well was to be tested. Safe sources of water were to be provided. But the race against time has gone badly. Suspicious of each other, the World Bank and the government became stubbornly bound up in their mutual bureaucracies, many critics say. Most of the country's estimated 11 million wells have yet to be tested. Most stricken villages are absent solutions. Most people, the trusting converts to the, quote, safety of tube wells, are baffled when now told that within the water lie the malign beginnings of arsenic-induced cancer. Alan Smith, an epidemiologist at the University of California, Berkeley, and an expert on arsenic, has called the situation in Bangladesh the highest environmental cancer risk ever found, worse than Bhopal or Chernobyl. We're going to start now with a man who first started to identify what was happening in Bangladesh. He is the director of environmental science at the University, Jadavpur University in Calcutta. And he is currently in California at a major arsenic conference where most of our guests are also joining us. Dr. Chakraborty, welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Can you start off by going back in time, say 14, 15 years, when you started to realize what was happening?
Yeah, you know that the West Bengal, a part of the India, is also arsenic affected. While working on the bordering line between Bangladesh and West Bengal, I found that Bangladesh should be arsenic affected because I have got many patients from Bangladesh who came after marriage to India. So immediately I informed UNICEF and WHO of Bangladesh about the whole calamity. But the pity is that even they did not reply my letter. Later on, I met the officials of Bangladesh government in this respect and warned them that Bangladesh's problem may be more than West Bengal. Even the same history repeats itself. That means they did not even recognize the whole problem. Even at that time, it happened that I was called the panic creator and making people mad, telling them that the water is arsenic contaminated. You know how the fun is. Now Alan Smith is telling that the most cancerous risk will be Bangladesh. Then in course of time in 1998 with Dhaka Community Hospital, I made a venture and surveyed the arsenic affected areas of Bangladesh. Within 14 days, I found 21 districts affected and it immediately came to the limelight. Later on in 1998, we made an international conference with Dhaka Community Hospital. And then the scientists all over the world came, and the WHO, UNICEF, all were telling that it is not a problem. They are telling out of every 10 deaths, one death will be from cancer due to the arsenic in the southern part of the Bangladesh.
When you do these studies, When you just go back to Bangladesh, what exactly do you see? What are the people suffering from? What are the symptoms?
It was devastating. It was devastating. It's unbelievable. And the most pity is that the villagers even did not know that they're suffering from these arsenic toxins. And what's the solution of this problem? Problem is highlighted. What is the solution? You know, the Bangladesh's available surface water is 11,000 cubic meter per capita. I told many times that Malaysia's economy is on selling water to Singapore. Israel is buying water from Sudan. Now, Bangladesh has so much water that it can even sell their water to neighboring countries. What happened? Why they did not utilize their 3,000 millimeter of rainfall, surface water, flooded river basins, Oxbow lakes? Instead of that, who promoted them to take out the underground water? And it's UNICEF. They told that you will not suffer from diarrhea and all other things if you take out the underground water. So the culture of the underground water started. You know, when the first tube well was sunk in Nodia in West Bengal, people left the village crying, devil's water is coming, devil's water is coming. And now you will find that the people, if you ask them, what do you want? They will say, I need my own tube well. So the culture has come. My saying, why? Why the aid agencies, you have never taken care of the all available surface water? Nature in her laboratory for thousands and thousands of years made some rules and regulations. And who you are, die to break that rules and take out the mother's earth blood and creating this type of the problem like arsenic. Arsenic is not the end point. Wait, what will come next? You know that in India, 65 million people are suffering from fluorosis, again from the underground water. Well, if we do not have the water, that's something else. But do we have the water? We can make a rainwater harvest. We can make our old type of the dug wells. Well, the people will tell dug well, it will create another diarrhea, cholera, etc. But that technology is known. Now, America is telling in this century, they will make the toilet flush as a bottled water. So when technology is known, why we are going down to the earth to take out the blood and creating all these problems?
Dr. Chakraborty, where is the arsenic coming from?
Yeah, it is in the underground sediment. So when they're taking out the water, it was there, and now it is coming out with the water. This is not the natural solution. Nature never tells that take out, you know, that Bangladesh, West Bengal, they're in the big delta. And the recent results coming out, the whole Gangetic Plain will be arsenic affected, starting from the Himalayas down to Chandigarh, to upper Delta Plain, middle Delta Plain, and lower plain. That means lower is the Delta Plain. And in this middle zone, recently we have found Bihar is arsenic contaminated. And can you imagine, 100 million people are in the Bihar. And when I went to the villages of the Bihar, they told for 20 years they're suffering from this problem. Why? Why aid agencies, you are spending millions of dollars for field kit, which is useless? They have spent millions and millions of dollars for the field kit and just going to spend more on the field kit, but never taking care of the people. You know, more than $50 or $60 million has already come to Bangladesh. But I am asking, how much has gone for the people? They are giving soft loans sometime. Why? And 50% of that money goes to the foreign consultant. Why? Why this money is not going for the people who are suffering seriously? Even 20 years after the problem, which is in Bangladesh, it started, I think, before 1975. Still, the people are in the worse condition than what they were earlier.
Dr. Dipankar Chakraborty is a head of environmental studies at Jatavpur University in Calcutta, India. When we come back, we will also be joined by a number of people, including Dr. Richard Wilson of the Harvard Department of Physics faculty and co-author of Risk-Benefit Analysis, looking at arsenic in Bangladesh, the largest mass poisoning of a population in history. Stay with us.
Did I drink some poison?
Did I drink some poison?
That I don't remember now.
That I don't remember now. Is the blood on my hands? to something in another lifetime. It was really, really me.
Yeah, I'm hearing voices. Am I losing my mind? Think I'm going crazy, gotta get out.
Run into the street, start to shout. Get out of my way, get out, get out. Did I drink some poison that I don't remember now? Is the blood on my hand?
Poison. Laurie Anderson, here on Democracy Now!, as we talk about the largest mass poisoning of a population in history, and we're talking about something that is happening today. 35 million Bangladeshis exposed to arsenic-laced water. We've just been hearing Dr. Dipankar Chakraborty, who is head of environmental studies at Jadavpur University in Calcutta, India, one of the first to identify this mass poisoning. Richard Wilson with the Harvard Department of Physics is with us, also at the Arsenic Conference in California. Can you tell us about the scope of this? How many Bangladeshis do you expect to die of arsenic poisoning?
Well, the number one expects is about a million, and about 35 people exposed at a level higher than the American standard of the present, and 85 million above the standard that we expect to put into place. So that's a huge number, and about a million of these people will actually die in one way. And, you know, some people say it's 5 million, some people say it's 500,000. But the number staggers the imagination, and it overwhelms the capability of people to cope with it. And Dr. Chakraborty is absolutely right that the problem is getting the help to the people. And there's a crisis not only of arsenic in Bangladesh, there's a crisis of capability of people to actually cope with it. And I was able to provide $10,000 to the people in Dhaka Community Hospital earlier this year, and they produced pure water for replacing 50 tube wells. Now, if we just multiply that up, $20 million provided to the people will solve the problem. The difficulty is how you get it to there without passing through all the sticky fingers, which are both in this country and in Bangladesh.
Well, there was an interesting part in the New York Times article that refers to the kind of bureaucratic bungling is as far as they went between the World Bank and the government of Bangladesh. What is going on here?
Well, it's almost inherent in the World Bank. By its nature, it works with governments, and it likes the governments to behave in a certain way. And the government of Bangladesh is not behaving in the same way and the way the World Bank would like. And so they are arguing with each other, and it would take a few years for that to be resolved. Meanwhile, the crisis is going on. And so what is necessary is somehow to bypass the World Bank, to bypass the government of Bangladesh, to get straight to the organizations which are going out and dealing with the people, like Professor Chakraborty and the people he works with and I work with, the Dhaka Community Hospital.
Can you talk about how arsenic kills?
Well, we didn't really know how arsenic killed. It was really a surprise to the whole world until about 15 years ago, when it was discovered that the wells in Taiwan, deep wells in Taiwan, were contaminated with arsenic and producing the problems. Firstly, it kills by giving keratoses and skin problems all over the body. Now, if you're a farmer and you have keratoses and you can't walk any longer and you tend to walk barefoot anyway, you have real problems, you get gangrene, and then you have to get your foot cut off, then you can't feed your family. But worse still, if you go on for 20 years, then you get lung cancer, you get bladder cancer, you get skin cancers, and from those you can die.
We're also joined on the telephone by Han Heinen. He is the environmental health advisor on Bangladesh for the World Health Organization. Dr. Dipankar Chakraborty had harsh words for UNICEF, for the World Health Organization, for all of these international institutions. What is your response to that, Dr. Heinen?
Good morning. We have been working very nicely with Dr. Chakraborty. He has informed WHO already in 1988, I believe, because that was the first time that WHO in its bulletin published work of Dr. Chakraborty on the problems at the time acknowledged in West Bengal. And since 1993, after he indeed, as he mentioned, identified a number of patients, WHO, together with the Bangladesh Atomic Energy Commission, did some studies in one particular area identified by him, Chapai Nawabganj, and indeed identified that there was a problem. The unfortunate thing at the time was that, and other experts will assert that, it was very difficult to test for arsenic. Actually, in Bangladesh, there was only one agency, an excellent laboratory, Bangladesh Atomic Energy Commission, that could do it. And so, whereas WHO then suggested to the government to do a larger study, that took about 2 years to take off. So, indeed, I can agree with Dr. Chakraborty that the takeoff of investigation and subsequent action took quite some time. And obviously, as you suggested from the article in the New York Times and what Dick Wilson is saying, subsequently, one would have faced quite a number of problems indeed in mobilizing government, in mobilizing various parties that support the government, be they NGOs or aid agencies, in order to start resolving these problems.
Dr. Chakraborty, does that satisfy you? Dr. Chakraborty, does that satisfy you?
Oh, well, I think that the way it should be on the war footing, the way it should be done, I think it has not been done.
How does it need to be done?
I think this is, people should be aware. People should let them know that this is not the curse of God or wrath of God. We have done it, and we have the resource. Instead of going the money to the foreign consultants, to the bureaucrats, to the people, never reaching to the people. Why? Why it will be like that, spending millions for field kits whose outcome is zero?
Dr. Heinen of World Health Organization?
Yeah, I must say that I have no disagreement with Deepankar at all in this way. As a matter of fact, the original design of part of the World Bank program also had an emergency component. And unfortunately, that got somehow a little bit scuttled due to, indeed, administrative reasons. But indeed, I fully agree. I mean, this matter has to be put onto a war footing. And if it is going to be on a war footing, it also means, and this is, I think, one serious problem that we face, it also means that you have to inform people. You have to inform everyone about the issue, about the risks, and then, of course, the consequence is that you will also be able, you should also be able to tell them what to do about it. But I feel, and I've mentioned it many times, if I'm the father of my children, and if I live in a village in Bangladesh, then I have the right to know what is affecting my future as a household, as a family. And that also means that I need to know whether there is arsenic in my well, what I can do about it, how I can organize myself, my community, together with government, together with private sector, together with NGOs, in order to find sustainable solutions. And that requires a long-term, repetitive, in different ways, no doubt, communication campaign about this. Now, about 4 years ago, when I arrived in Bangladesh, some people said, well, you can't do that because we do not have the solutions. True, at the time, maybe, but I'm very happy to hear that Deepankar is mentioning rainwater harvesting. I mean, when I came to the country, I came from Sri Lanka, where I had worked for an NGO for a number of years, and there we had very successfully implemented, also from scratch, basically, people were not used to it, large-scale rainwater harvesting programs. And I said, it must be possible to also do that in Bangladesh, because in my opinion, rainwater harvesting is part of the solution. And I must say that at the moment, partly also with the assistance of IDE, International Development Enterprises, and a small entrepreneurial NGO from the United States, we have been able to not just promote rainwater harvesting, but essentially be able to cut down the cost of rainwater harvesting systems to below one taka per liter, which means that a lot of people, also poor people, are able to access it. So solutions are coming in. Now, if solutions are coming in, then, of course, it is the argument that we should not inform people is completely eliminated. But to my mind, I mean, people have a right to know. That's true in the United States, and it's just as well true in Bangladesh. And so, therefore, we have to push especially the communication campaigns that make people able to take action and decisions for themselves.
Dr. Chakraborty referred to Dhaka Hospital. We have on the line with us also Dr. Kwasi Kamruzzaman, who is founder and chair of the Dhaka Community Hospital Trust and professor of pediatric surgery at the Bangladesh Institute of Child Health. Can you talk about who the hospital has treated, how many people, and what you're doing right now?
Good morning. This discussion is, I think, is giving us quite a bit of information as well. I think we, in 1996, first found some patient down in one of our rural center, and we made some, this is publicized. But now we are hearing that since 1993, WHO knew there is a arsenic crisis in Bangladesh. It is a big news then, because during that period, millions of people continued exposing themselves. Another thing I think we should, before I tell you about what we are doing, is that quite a few things quite apparent here, is that there is always a tendency of playing down the situation. When we made this information public that arsenic is now found in drinking water, actually, there is like Dipankar Chakraborty. We are termed as a panic mongering, and we had to nearly some of the time at that time we had to really hide ourselves to save ourselves from bureaucratic and other people who are involved in this safe drinking water program in Bangladesh from T-Boys. And then at this moment, still that thing is playing down. Because we are mentioning that only 35 million people probably exposed to arsenic. I think it is now established with the work of Jadavpur University and us, more than 85 million people at this moment drinking arsenic contaminated water. So this is another very interesting thing I noticed. Another thing I noticed is that in the field, we 4 years or 5 years ago, we are only used to see skin lesions of keratosis melanosis. Now, last 1 or 2 years, we are finding patients mostly from cancers. We have treated now in a community hospital more than 16,000 people, randomly coming from all over the country. And out of them, we have operated 95 people as a cancer, in which is more or less terminal conditions. And we are finding people, even with cancer, below the age of 15. And this is the situation at this moment. And every day, more areas, people are going to finding out, and more areas, patients are coming. So, which is, as Dr. Chakraborty predicted, we are with him at that time, that this is going to happen. Actually, it is already happening. This is one. And why nothing has nothing been done or nothing been happening? One thing is we noticed, I'm also a member of National Expert Committee. We are sort of more advisory capacity. I have the opportunity to see what is going on very close range. There is a very much a bureaucratic suspicion, as mentioned by the New York Times, between the agencies working, both the international agency, World Bank, and the government. And the most important thing we noticed is the faulty design of the mitigation solutions. Till now, we are just at all the money, the loan money, everything has been playing on just testing tube wells. And even the tube wells which we are now finding not having arsenic, we are finding within 6 months or so, they're becoming arsenic contaminated. So, but the whole approach of these projects now, from the donors, from the government, is just testing tubers.
I want to ask Dr. Wilson from Harvard a question for a minute. I'm looking at a Financial Times piece that talks about a Bangladeshi professor launching a new filter that could prevent the deadly chemical, arsenic, reaching water supplies. That costs about $4, could help up to 80 million people at risk from arsenic poisoning. Can you put, Dr. Wilson, can you put this amount of money in context? What is being spent, and what are we spending it on?
I'll tell you something else. We are not, actually our experience shows, there is one scientifically, and also our experience shows, there is no filter which cleans the arsenic, and the sludge which collects from this after cleaning the arsenic, there is no scientifically possible to dispose them. It takes 1,000 years to dispose this arsenic.
The Financial Times refers to a filter by Professor Fakhrul Islam, a chemist from Rajshahi University, that contains crushed brick, which is mixed and heated with ferrous sulfate.
Actually, there is quite a few filters. His filter is probably called Shapla filters. There are Shofi filters. There are a lot of filters now at this moment using in Bangladesh. And it is very unfortunate because the Bangladesh people have been now treated as like a guinea pig, when these filters are probably should have been treated and tested in laboratory, because many of these filters works only for a very short period of time. Then they doesn't work. And I think this is one of the very dangerous thing happening to Bangladesh again, is that a lot of experiments going on without being tested and clarified in the laboratory. Mm. And I think Dipankar Chakraborty is saying, and all the scientists are saying, arsenic removal is not a possible, first, as a massive scale. Second, there's a sludge. After removing the arsenic, what are you going to do with this arsenic? It is like a nuclear material. You cannot just dispose of anywhere. Is going to collect. And when Bangladesh has got one of the highest per capita surface water, which 1,000 years we are using, why these donors and these designers putting these filters to the people? Well, and in our experience in the field, working in the field, in a few thousand villages we're working, actually this is the rural poor which is affected. Very few of them has got affordability to do or use this filter, and they are are not that much of I would say educated.
Well, let me
continue to use them.
Let me ask Dr. Wilson that question about how much solutions would cost compared to what is being spent today. I mean, the Bush administration is talking about a so-called war on terror all over the world, declaring war, putting a lot of money into armaments. You have this population, you're talking about roughly 1 million people, perhaps more, who are dying from something that sounds preventable. Can you put the monies in context of what's being spent and what isn't being spent?
Of course, you have a very important point here, that peace is always cheaper than war. And here we have, the claim is the filters can be $4 each.
I can't quite understand. We're going to switch lines for 1 minute. We're going to switch lines so that we can understand what you're saying. Go ahead.
Peace is always cheaper than war.
Just one sec. We're going to put him on the line that we had previously.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello, yes. Peace is always cheaper than war. And indeed, you can make a pond filter for a filter for the arsenic for $4. You could certainly, for $40 million, treat all the world, all the sugar. However, the question of the flood is very important, and the question of maintenance of that filter is something which has never been looked at properly, as Raman was correctly saying. So one of the problems
I'm going to just get in the step in right here. We're going to go to a break. We're going to clean up your line. And we're also going to speak with a lawyer in Britain who is suing the British Geological Survey on behalf of people in Bangladesh. We're having a conversation right now with scientists from around the world, from Bangladesh, from India, from here in the United States, about the largest mass poisoning of a population in history, and it's the arsenic poisoning of the population of Bangladesh. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Whatever we do, do to the earth, we do to ourselves. We must try to survive. We die if we let ourselves forget that in El Mosote, oh, the shame came to pass once again. She hid herself away while her children fell, but she lived to tell. The only surviving soul, she witnessed it all, but it must be told. Scattered clothes, babies' bones, burned and maimed, all destroyed, but her blood makes the rain.
Jolie Rickman, El Mosote, here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the arsenic poisoning of the people of Bangladesh, some of the victims are suing the British Geological Survey, which did not include a test for arsenic when it surveyed the groundwater of Bangladesh in 1992. We turn now to Bojena Michalowska, who is a lawyer for the plaintiffs. She is in London right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi. Can you talk about what this suit is about and why the British Geological Survey is involved?
Well, as you just said, in 1992, the BGS was funded to test for the toxicity of groundwater to fish and humans and the hydrochemical character of the groundwater, but specifically to test the toxicity and its suitability for drinking water purposes in central and northeast Bangladesh. As you know, the BGS failed to test for arsenic, despite the fact that arsenic is one of the inorganic constituents of health significance identified in the 1984 WHO guidelines. Their report and subsequent analysis gave the water, or the groundwater, a clean bill of health. If they had tested for arsenic in 1992, they would have found it. And if it had been identified in 92 on the scale that it exists at the moment, the mitigation programs would have been introduced much sooner, and large swathes of those suffering from illnesses now would have stopped drinking contaminated water and would never have accumulated the body burden of arsenic necessary to cause the damage seen.
The British Geological Survey was employed to do this in 1992. Was this at the time where the people of Bangladesh were being told to stop drinking from the ponds and move to wells? Is that why they were asked to do this survey?
The reason why they were asked to do the survey was, as identified in the report, the fact that there was a severe lack of reliable data on water quality. Previously, the agencies and NGOs had been concerned with provision of clean water to them, to get clean water to them quickly. But they didn't have the facilities in Bangladesh to test for the quality and the hydrochemical character of the water. So an opportunity came up where the BGS could test in the UK for the quality of the water. And that was the main purpose behind it. so as to produce reliable data that could be relied on by other agencies and those concerned with provision of drinking water.
And talk about who you're representing.
We're representing those suffering from arsenicosis who are living in the areas that were tested by the BGS in 1992.
And what has been the response of the British Geological Survey?
The main response at present is that they felt that there was no reason for them to test for arsenic, as they felt that they didn't expect to find it in the groundwater there.
Well, let me go to Dr. Richard Wilson. Should they have done a test for arsenic? Is that an obvious test to do? Dr. Wilson.
Hello, I'm sorry, I didn't quite clear the question.
Would it have been an obvious test to do, a test for arsenic? Or would there have been no reason for the British Geological Survey or the World Health Organization or others to test when they're switching people from one water supply to another?
Well, in the first part of the century, it might have been forgivable not doing it because people hadn't realized that arsenic was such a bad actor. But since 1986, when the results came out from Taiwan, everybody who knew anything in the world was alerted to the idea there might be a problem. And you should, and certainly, even as early as 1970, the U.S. Geological Survey was routinely testing for arsenic. And I think my colleagues in Harvard would have recommended testing.
Dr. Chakraborty, as we wrap up this discussion, how you feel about the institutions that did the tests or didn't, and what you feel needs to be done at this point.
Of the British Geology was present in the international conference in Calcutta in 1995. The representative was present in that conference. They knew about the whole thing. Even after that, you see Vietnam, Hanoi, even they did not test the groundwater of the Vietnam, and now you will find in the Vietnam millions are drinking from that arsenic-contaminated water. I think they have neglected it completely. They did not feel that it's important to test all these toxins. The history say that in West Bengal, in India, in 1937, the first death occurred from underground water of the fluoroseas. So they knew that the groundwater contains toxins. And arsenic problem was known even in the Lancet, in paper 1976, the paper came out on the arsenic toxicity of India in Chandigarh. It was blamed that after the international conference in Calcutta in 1995, the scientists of the Western scientists came to know about the arsenic problem. That's not true. The papers came out in 1992 also. So in my opinion, they completely neglected the whole issue. They did not think that it is something. Millions will die. What's the problem?
Well, Dr. Deepankar Chakraborty, head of environmental studies at Jadavpur University in Calcutta, I want to thank you for being with us. Dr. Richard Wilson of Harvard. Also from Britain, we spoke with one of the lawyers suing the British Geological Survey, and as well the doctor who heads Dhaka Hospital that is doing all of the tests right now of people who are dying of arsenic poisoning. We will certainly continue this story as this story unfolds. We are going to turn for a few minutes to India, where two survivors of the Bhopal Union Carbide disaster have been hospitalized after an 8-day fast protesting the Bhopal disaster 17 years ago. We're going to end the program with them. But right now, we're joined in the studio by another guest who we've had on the phone and in our studio. He has come back into New York for a few days. And we're switching gears entirely to talk about a protest and trials that have happened in the last week of people who've been protesting at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. They protested months ago. They were tried in the last week. And right now, Doctor, I'm so used to speaking to doctors during this program. Reverend Roy Bourgeois is with us. A federal judge last week sentenced 29 human rights activists to up to 6 months in federal prison and placed seven on probation after they were convicted of trespassing at a protest against the U.S. Army School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia. Can you talk about this latest round of convictions and sentencing? Welcome to Democracy Now.
There were 27 who were brought to trial because of the protests last year, as 10,000 from all over the country gathered at the main gate to call for the closing of the School of the Americas, now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. Now, they were arrested because of entering Fort Benning charged with trespass. The trial took place all last week. Of the 37 tried, 29 were found guilty. They're going to prison. They will join 70 before them who have collectively served over 40 years in federal prisons around the country for protesting what we see as a school for terrorists here on U.S. soil. They're very representative of the SOA Watch movement that make up thousands. On trial, the defendants were college students, the youngest 19 years old. The oldest in the group, 72 years old, Catholic priest from California. Their grandparents, their veterans, their teachers, parents who have young children at home. What they have in common is they know, they're very knowledgeable of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America. They know that this school that they're calling to close really provides the muscle for U.S. economic interests in Latin America. Now, something very important, they're going to prison. They're going to energize our movement. Abby Miller, 23 years old from Pennsylvania, one of the defendants, said it very well as she spoke, I think, for the majority there. She said, "This is not about us. Really, we are here to use our voices for sisters and brothers in Latin America. We are here to express our solidarity with the struggle going on in Latin America. And we are going to prison for them." And we've learned also, Amy, as we've gone to prison in the past, they will again, we're now up to 99 of people in the movement, activists who have served many years in prison for closing down the school. We've learned that they cannot silence us. The 29 are going to prison, and they will speak from prison. The truth cannot be silenced, and they will energize our movement. This coming November, November the 16th and 17th, we're going to gather once again at the main gate of Fort Benning by the thousands. I invite our listeners to be there with us.
Can you talk about how this fits into what's going on in this country and around the world right now with the so-called war on terror? Has it changed your tactics, and how do you fit what's going on in the school into that?
Well, actually, you know, it was a week after 9/11 that I got a call from the commanding general of Fort Benning. Not to coming November, he said. We're at war with terrorism, and this is not a time to be protesting. You know, we called our leaders all over the country from California to New York to get their opinion about the general's request not to come to protest at the main gate of Fort Benning. And everyone we spoke with in our movement said, look, it is more important than ever for us to be there. Our president keeps saying that we're at war with terrorism. We've got to go after those training camps for the terrorists wherever they exist. And the best place to start is at this terrorist training camp on U.S. soil at Fort Benning, Georgia, the School of the Americas. And really, for years, we have been referring to this school as a terrorist training camp for Latin America. How else do you describe the massacres? El Masote, over 900 killed, including over 100 children, the rape and murder of church women, torture, assassinations. I must say, at the trial also, with some very important testimony. Major Joseph Blair, former instructor at the school, took the stand and said when he was an instructor at the school, torture was taught at the school. It was taught for some 11 years, and he's calling for the closure of this school. He's joined our voice to ours, and I encourage people to check out our website. There are a lot of photographs and more information. SOAW.org.
SOAW.org. Well, I want to thank you very much Father Roy Bourgeois, for being with us.
Thank you.
As we turn back in the last few minutes of the program to the streets of Delhi, where two of three Bhopal hunger strikers, Rashida Bey and Tara Bey, fainted during a rally by Bhopal survivors. On the night of December 2nd and 3rd, 1984, 40 tons of methyl isocyanate, hydrogen cyanide, monomethyl amine, and other lethal gases spewed from the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal. The death toll there, about 20,000, and many are still suffering. We go to the streets now where one hunger striker remains. We turn right now to Satinath Sarangi, longtime Bhopal activist. Why are you in the streets?
We are here. We have been on the street since the 26th of June. Since 29th, we were on hunger strike, mainly with two demands. Our first demand is that the Central Bureau of Investigation, which is a prosecuting agency, that has sought to dilute the charges against Warren Anderson, prime accused in the Union Carbide disaster case. And while Warren Anderson was charged with culpable homicide and other serious offenses...
Warren Anderson, the former CEO of Union Carbide.
Yeah. And while he was charged with culpable homicide, the Central Bureau of Investigation now, under directions from the government, wishes to dilute the charges and make it into a rash and negligent act by thus turning the world's horriblest industrial massacre into a car accident. But more importantly, this would mean that he would not be extradited to India. And that will be the end of the case.
It's very interesting in light of the conversation that's going on in this country as Congress deals with the issue of corporate crimes. They're hardly dealing with something, the scope and scale of Bhopal that you're still living with today.
Exactly. And this is more than, it's not just white-collar crime. It's white-collar crime of a different kind. It kills people, and it's still killing people. And the other demand we had was that the government is now contemplating that the money that is left behind is balanced from the settlement fund, which is rupees 13.6 billion. What the Indian government wants to do is to use this money to clean up part of this money to clean up the contamination in and around the Bhopal factory that has been abandoned by Union Carbide, leaving 5,000 tons of toxic chemicals behind. And those chemicals are seeping into the water. What we are saying is that this is the responsibility of Dow Chemicals, because Dow Chemical has merged with Union Carbide last year, and since it has inherited the assets, it inherits the liabilities as well. But Dow refuses to accept these liabilities, and now Indian government is actually robbing the gas victims of their money to bail Dow out of this situation and actually paying for what Dow should be doing. So we are saying that we insist on Dow being made responsible for this cleanup, and the Indian government shouldn't be using the gas victims' money to do the cleanup.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Satinath Satu Sarangi, for joining us again in the streets of Delhi in the midst of a hunger fast, has protested now, been fasting for close to 3 weeks. You are listening to Democracy Now! If you'd like to get a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for more information. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Richard Adams, Michael Yeh. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro as we go out with the music live in our firehouse studio of Jolie Rickman. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Well, that SOA went wild over me, and they say that I destroyed their property. Well, they say I wrecked their sign, but to me it looked just fine. And they went wild, simply wild over me. And that judge, he went wild over me, and I knew that.